and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
Deliver on putting Nigeria back to work and ensuring that those issues that have been creating within the Republic itself is addressed with a document that is acceptable and legitimate.
A Nigerian human rights activist and publisher of Sahara Reporters declares plans to run for president in next year's general election.
Everyone understands that we are neutral and that we are there to deliver medical care and that we must not be attacked. This is what we mean by protection. Don't touch ambulance, don't touch hospitals. It does not mean we want armless court.
Doctors Without Borders announces plans to pull out of its project in Nizi and Bambu in the DRC.
The media should do better. The media should inform people adequately, sufficiently, timelessly, so that people get to know what is happening around the country where the by-elections are being undertaken.
And Zimbabwe holds key parliamentary and local government biannual elections Saturday. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Nigeria, a human rights activist and publisher of Sahara Reporters has declared plans to run for president in next year's general election. Omoyele Sowore says he plans to run an efficient government that will solve Nigeria's socioeconomic and security challenges. He's critical of the government's failure to resolve high youth unemployment and growing insecurity from bandits and militant groups, including Boko Haram, in parts of the country. Sowore says he plans to implement measures that will focus on job creation, workers' welfare, free education, and pension reforms. For more about his plans to contest in next year's general election, I reach aspiring candidate Omoyele Sowore in the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
So my candidacy is born out of a historical necessity at this time. We started, by the way, in 2019, when I came out and ran for the presidency of Nigeria, having discovered that every one of the candidates at that time who were coming out had no capability to manage Nigeria towards success. And I was rigged out of that process. In fact, I've said it severally that there was no election in 2019. Nobody can convince me otherwise. After that, we'll of course introduce to Nigerians a dimension that they had not known before. We started campaigning that the country was in need of a revolutionary, and it was in need of a revolution as well. That led to my detention trial that is still ongoing but failed. And now people are better convinced that the old, incompetent, corrupt politicians in Nigeria have ruined their country. And if we don't act now, we'll wake up one day and find out that we don't have a country in existence anymore. So this is the rescue plan for Nigeria, and the entire world should pay attention to it, because you can't afford this place to explode or implode. I mean, the nation of Nigeria.
But Mr. Sowore, what do you think makes you uniquely qualified to become Nigeria's next president?
It is based on experience, it's based on character, it's based on history. The democracy that Nigeria is enjoying today, I was one of the people that fought for it when I arrived at university in 1989. That was 32 years ago. I fought several military rulers, and Nigeria came to have democracy in 1999. I left the shores of Nigeria, ended up in the U.S., spent 20 years and attended college, started a successful business known as Sahara Reporters, and then decided to come home because, as we love to say in those days when we were in secondary school, that east or west, home is the best.
You face a stiff challenge from the candidate from the main opposition, People's Democratic Party, former Vice President Atiku Abubakar, and then APC chieftain, former governor of Lagos, your state, Ashiwaju Ahmed Bola
Tinubu also wants to become the next president. How do you think you can defeat them, since some people say they have what Nigerians usually expect from their presidential candidate, a lot of money on their side to organize and to campaign? What makes you think that you can defeat them to become the next president?
Let me speak directly to why they'll be defeated this time around. It is that we now have about 80% of our population who are tired of money bags, godfathers, buccaneers in this country who have held the country to ransom. People have kidnapped their destinies. And we're hearing from this population, particularly young people, that they are ready to battle, to go to battle with these money bags. If all they have is money, then I can tell you that this time around, the race is over. It is time, I mean, the time is up against that kind of old politics. Of course, they will throw the money around, no doubt, but this time around, money cannot save them because people are looking now for ideas. They are looking for content, and they are looking for character, and they are looking for men with courage, people who have a vision, and not all these blind men who have been riding roughshod on the political arena for several decades now.
Mr. Sowore, what will you change in Nigeria? Were they to give you the nod in next February to become the next president, if I may ask you, and what should be the expectations of you?
You know, I'm careful not to reveal too many of my plans, because when I did it in 2019, these plagiarists and thieves stole my ideas and did not even have the decency, because they are not decent people, to let people know that they stole these ideas. We created a website, and it's still in existence in 2019, where we have what we call Spicer Heat, which would be to tackle a number of issues and the other priorities, starting with security, you know, reviving or even starting all over again a power sector that can deliver electricity and real energy, fighting corruption, building infrastructure, you know, turning Nigeria into a construction site. But beyond just those issues, Nigeria has a fundamental, foundational problem right now. The constitution of Nigeria, which was bequeathed to this republic, as they call it, the Fourth Republic, in 1999, it's a fraudulent document created by the military. Nigerians are agitating for, you know, a constitution that is original and organic and that can deliver on putting Nigeria back to work and ensuring that those issues that have been creating within the republic itself is addressed with a document that is acceptable and legitimate.
Omoyele Sowore is a human rights activist and publisher of Sahara Reporters. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. The political pressure group called Concern Nigeria for the Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law, a seven-day ultimatum to the Economic and Financial Crimes Commission, or EFCC. The group is demanding an inquiry into allegations of corruption against any aspiring presidential candidates. It also says the presidential candidate should be held to the highest standards to ensure Nigerians get the best leaders to administer the affairs of the country. The pressure group says it will revive a court case against Asiwa Jubola Ahmed Tinubu, a former Lagos State governor and a prominent member of the ruling All Progressive Congress, or APC. This after Mr. Tinubu announced plans to run for president in 2023. The former governor made his plans known following a recent meeting with President Muhammadu Buhari. Deji Adeyanju is the head of Protection of Human Rights and Rule of Law. He tells me that the aspiring candidates should be cleared of all wrongdoing before being allowed to contest in next year's elections.
Yes, the ultimatum is because for over 2 years, our subsisting petition at the commission has been ignored. And now we see that Tinubu is planning to be president, highest office in the country. And it behoves on us as a responsible civil rights group to ask the EFCC to either commence proceedings against him for clear violation of the Money Laundering Act, Money Laundering Prohibition Act, especially precisely Section 1 of that act, when he ferried Willie Evans to his home the eve of elections, you know, and the provisions, the clear provisions of that act says no individual can be in custody of more than 5 million naira. And that's not only the issue that we want the EFC to delve in. There's subsisting petitions at with the Commission on Alpha, Beta, and several stories of corruption. So we want political office holders to be held to the highest standard, you know, and those seeking to run the affairs of our country to be held to the highest possible standard. If there's an investigative report exonerating him, we also want EFCC to provide us that. So, and that's why we're giving them a 7-day ultimatum.
But the EFCC could be conducting an investigation right now. How would you know if their investigation is going on?
No, the EFCC is is not a private entity. It's a public, the public agency. You know, the EFCC is paid by taxpayers' money, Nigerians. So there's no excuse to say the EFCC cannot tell Nigerians specific information that Nigerians need. You know, so the EFCC must tell Nigerians. It's a public institution. The EFCC is a public institution. You know, and the EFCC is accountable to the Nigerian people. So all what we are demanding is accountability on the side of the EFCC. That's what we are demanding. We're asking the EFCC to do its job. If the EFCC fails to do its job, we are going to approach the court and seek order of mandamus to compel EFCC to do their job.
Is that your next line of action if the ultimatum expires?
Yes. Our letter to the EFCC, which is also a reminder of the 2018 petition, is clear. But if the EFCC fails to act within 7 working days, we are going to approach the court to get an order of mandamus to compel them to do their job.
Have you presented any empirical evidence to the EFCC to investigate these allegations?
What other evidence is needed than the bullion vans that were parked right in front of Tinubu's house in the eve of the last election? What other evidence is needed?
Some people will suggest that the bullion vans were empty.
Okay, so it's still part of the regulation that the EFCC should investigate, and come up with the resolution. That is exactly why we are calling on EFCC to do his job.
Some people are suggesting that you are being used by his political enemies to go after him, claiming all kinds of allegations. Mm. How do you respond to that?
Over 2 years ago, when we wrote the petition, was anybody using us? Did we compel Ashwajibola and Tinubu to ferry bullion vans to his own house on the eve of the last general election? We didn't. So, and he must be held accountable for his actions. You know, nobody should be above the law. The EFCC should not engage in selective prosecution, which is exactly what they are currently doing.
Deji Adeyanju is the head of protection of human rights and rule of law. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Rights Watch says the Ugandan government has yet to hold security officials accountable for alleged human rights violations. In its latest report, the International Human Rights Organization compiled allegations of torture of hundreds of government critics and protesters. The group says it is engaging the government to address its concerns. But supporters of the government rejected the report's findings. This after President Yoweri Museveni and his government say they don't endorse torture. Supporters also say critics seek to threaten the country's peace and stability and should be penalized. For more on the report, I reach Oriem Nyeko, Human Rights Watch's Uganda researcher.
Yeah, so the report is called I Only Need Justice, and it documents unlawful detention by security forces. This is something that has been happening for a very long time. We talk about and document security forces, being the police, the military, and other officials arresting people from their workplaces, their homes, and taking them to places, for the most part, that are not authorized by the law for people to be detained at, and holding them for months at end, and subjecting them to a range of different forms of torture, including beatings, having electric currents applied to their skin, as well as sexual violence, including rape. Our report talks about how those things happen, but also what the experiences of people who went through these experiences and have now been released, what they are going through now. And what we found was that they face a number of challenges, especially in obtaining justice.
But Oriem, the official government position is that torture is not a policy of the government.
The president has said that he doesn't condone torture. Other high-ranking officials have said that these acts are committed by rogue officials. They may say that, and they have said that for a long time, but the fact remains that security officials that are affiliated with the Ugandan government have been committing these abuses for a very long time. Our report, you know, documents cases from 2018 up to late 2021, but this has been happening for very many years. I think that if the government really doesn't condone these abuses, then they should end them immediately today. They should stop today, but they haven't.
President Museveni told VOA recently in an interview that torture doesn't work and that he has been trying hard to explain to the police they should not torture people and that he has a dossier of investigations going on to punish the perpetrators and all that. Why don't you think this is enough?
Well, first of all, it's not enough to just say it's wrong or that it shouldn't happen. We have to see real consequences. When people commit torture, when people arbitrarily arrest individuals, when people are unlawfully detained, which is illegal in Ugandan law and in international law, we have to see that the things that are supposed to happen, that is people actually being held accountable, being prosecuted for these abuses, we need to see that actually happen. And that has not been the case in Uganda. There's been little to no accountability for hundreds and hundreds of cases of these abductions and disappearances and torture. And I think that's the reason why it's just hot air, because we haven't seen the actual consequences for these abuses.
So for those victims that you spoke with that are seeking justice, what recourse do they have to address their concerns?
Well, legally, they should have recourse to the courts. They should also have access to redress from the Uganda Human Rights Commission, which is legally mandated to hear, to hold tribunals that give awards to victims of human rights abuses. But that has been limited. This is what we found, and we document in the report. For example, the Uganda Human Rights Commission basically wasn't functioning to hear those cases for about 2 years, because the chairperson had died and the president hadn't appointed a new chairperson. It's factors like that have just left, you know, the victims that we spoke to, who also spoke today during the launch in Kampala, just feeling like they haven't got any recourse. Nobody is helping them. So we're really advocating for the government to fulfill its role and to fulfill its obligations and make sure that those things that are supposed to happen actually happen.
Oriem Nyako is a Human Rights Watch Uganda researcher. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. In the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, Doctors Without Borders has announced plans to pull out of its project in Nizi and Bambu. The decision, officials say, came after parties in the conflict failed to assure the humanitarian group that its workers will be protected. This after the International Medical Organization's convoy of vehicles was attacked by unidentified armed men in Ituri province last year. Two of its staff members were wounded in the attack. Doctors Without Borders has since demanded an investigation into the attack and called on the parties of the conflict to condemn it, but the groups have yet to meet the demands of the organization. For more about the decision to pull out of its project and the impact it will have on the population, I reached via Skype Olivier Mazui, Program Manager for Doctors Without Borders in the DRC.
We decided to close our project in two locations named Nizi and Bambu in the Jugu territory of Ituri. We suffered an incident back in October when our convoy of two cars was shot at and two of our staff were wounded back then. At that time, we turned to the parties to the conflict and asked for a condemnation of that attack. And we did ask as well for a clear commitment to respect humanitarian law. Additionally, we had asked for an investigation to be conducted on that specific incident. Nearly 5 months after that, there was little progress. So we are in a situation where we have no other choice than closing our project.
But wouldn't this also negatively impact the residents who have been getting the much needed medical attention that you've been giving them in these areas?
Yes, it's, I would say, you know, against our hearts that we are taking this decision. But there is no other way. We cannot continue and put the lives of people at risk.
I understand some people are worried. In other parts where MSF has been providing some of these assistance, that if the attacks also increase there, there's a likelihood MSF might decide to pull out from there as well. Is there a danger of this happening?
Well, if we have taken this decision, it's also because this incident is unfortunately not unique. You know, there are a lot of incidents happening in the east of the Congo. There are a lot of attacks on civilian population. There are a lot of attacks on hospitals. There are a lot of attacks against ambulances, against patients. This cannot continue. Respect for patients, hospitals must be there. So as an act of solidarity, all MSF projects in Congo will be tomorrow suspended for 1 day. Colleagues in Congo will show their solidarity by this act, but it's also a way to communicate, to draw attention both at national and provincial level, but also at the very local level, to say to all the people of, you know, of influence, basically, you know, behave, pass the right message to all populations and all group. Respect hospitals, respect ambulance. We are not a target.
Well, some people are suggesting that perhaps you should talk to the UN and as well as the administration in Kinshasa, so at least you could have some FARDC forces to protect some of the areas where you operate, to ensure that your employees or those who volunteer to help these deprived communities are protected. What do you think?
We heard that message, but as humanitarians, we are neutral and impartial. We want parties to the conflict, meaning armed people of all sides, to respect humanitarian activity. And the word that is used is also to say to protect. But protect does not mean that we want a military or an armed escort. Protect means that we speak to everyone, that everyone understands that we are neutral and that we are there to deliver medical care and that we must not be attacked. This is what we mean by protection. Don't touch ambulance, don't touch hospitals. It does not mean we want armed escort.
Olivier Maizui is program manager for Doctors Without Borders in the DRC. He spoke with me from the DRC capital, Kinshasa.
Heidi Adams on the next Straight Talk Africa, as we explore Russia's rising influence in the Sahel region. We'll talk to the Prime Minister of Cote d'Ivoire and introduce you to the new President and CEO of the US African Development Foundation. All this and more on the next Straight Talk Africa, this Wednesday at 18:30 UTC.
You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Polisario Front has sharply condemned Spain's decision to endorse Morocco's plan for governing Western Sahara, a former Spanish colony. Morocco's plan allows the Sahrawis to run their own administration, but it will be under Morocco's sovereignty, while the North African country will be in charge of defense and foreign affairs. Spain's endorsement, some analysts say, seeks to ease tension between the government in Madrid and Rabat. The European Commission has welcomed Spain's new position, despite reports that the move is generating domestic opposition. The Polisario Front is recognized by the UN as the legitimate representatives of the Sahrawi people. Ambassador Malou Said is the representative of the Polisario Front in Washington, D.C. He tells me that his group is disappointed by Spain's decision.
The first conclusion is that blackmail pays off. I mean, the Moroccans for the last few years, they have been doing all kinds of blackmail pressure on the Spaniards, and they took advantage of the weakness of the present government of Spain. And at the end, although the Spanish government, they say they still with the United Nations and they need a they support a mutually acceptable solution by both parties, but they have been under pressure by the Morocco for the last few years. And as I said, because of the weakness of the Spanish government, they said that they support the autonomy and at the same time they support the United Nations peace process. But this is a decision that it completely left the government of Spain or the ruling party isolated in Spain. Even in the Spanish Congress, where they had a debate yesterday and they will have another debate next week, all the parties from the extreme left to the extreme right, with no exception, all of them, they condemned this new position. Even members of the coalition of the government, of the current government, they do not subscribe and they condemn this position. Therefore, it's not something which is endorsed by the Spanish Congress or by the Spanish opinion. In fact, as we speak, there are demonstrations in all the major cities in Spain against this decision. And next Saturday, they're expected to have a mega demonstration in Madrid where people come from the rest of Spain to denounce this decision. So this decision has made the government of Spain much more weaker domestically. And we are very happy by the reaction that was taken by the old government, all the parties, whether they are conservatives or the left progressive parties.
But Mr. Said, Madrid told the government in Rabat on Friday that it regarded its autonomy proposal for Western Sahara as serious, credible, and realistic. How do you respond to that?
We believe that there is nothing of serious or credible in the autonomy given by a dictator like the regime of the King of Morocco. And secondly, it's in violation of the international law. The only option here is to support the rights of the people of Western Sahara self-determination and to support the international law. That's the only option. Any other option is a violation of the United Nations principles and the United Nations resolution. And this is not the first time that the Spanish government have tried to sell the people of Western Sahara. Already in 1975, Spain sold Western Sahara to Morocco, and that's why the Sahrawi people are still suffering from that decision. And this is another try by the Spanish government to sell again the Sahrawi people. The difference is now the Sahrawi is very difficult to sell, and we count on our own forces and on our struggle. And also, fortunately, we have the support of so many people, in particular here in Spain at this moment.
But the European Commission has welcomed Spain's new position. How do you
No. The European Union Commission and the spokesman of the Commission, Mr. Borrell, he said he welcomed the rapprochement between Morocco and Spain. But he made very clear that the position of the European Union is still the same, has not changed, and has nothing to do with this rapprochement between the two countries. And the position of the European Union is to support the United Nations peace process. He made it very clear in a statement just a couple of days ago.
What is the next line of action of your group following this decision from Spain, which has been welcomed by the government in Morocco, by the way?
First, we're not speaking about a group, we're speaking about the people. And the next step of the Sahrawi people is to continue the struggle until we impose our rights to determination.
Ambassador Maloud Said is the representative of the Polisario Front in Washington, D.C. He spoke with me from Spain's capital, Madrid. Zimbabweans go to the polls today, Saturday, to elect council and parliamentary representatives. It's the first vote since 2018, and analysts say it could indicate which party voters may favor in next year's national balloting. The elections were supposed to be held in 2020, but were postponed due to the COVID-19 pandemic. The process has been somewhat peaceful and smooth, but marred with some hiccups. For VOA reporter Kutsai Svanavashi has more details from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
It's election day. Voters are being instructed to find their names on the voters' roll so they can proceed to get to the polling station and vote. Despite the occasion, voter turnout has been fairly low. Daniel Chigudu is the editor of Open Parli, an online publication that has been covering the elections.
We had anticipated that because an election is a very important exercise in the country, we had expected that maybe the powers that be would declare it a holiday so that people would be allowed a time from their work to go and vote, because we realized that there are people who work on Saturdays. And now, because Saturday is a working day, then it's a bread and butter issue where you have to decide whether you have to go to work to earn money or you have to go and vote.
Ephraim Sindo is a voter. He bemoans the process of looking for one's name before casting their vote. He says it's taking too long to get to find one's name, and that the Zimbabwe Election Commission, or ZEC, should provide someone to help voters find their name. He says it's not good to take an hour to find your name. It's as if they don't want you to vote. He says the state of the nation inspired him to go and vote. Charlton Wende is the Secretary General for the Opposition Citizens Coalition for Change.
The turnout is pleasing, although we think as we move towards lunchtime, many people will come. Some voters, their names are posted in different polling stations, even though they share the same surname, and also even if they are the same family. Then also there's old people who can't read. They've not put anyone to assist them locate their names. So it's also the problem that we have raised with ZEC. Then we also have discovered, shockingly, that the ink which is being used today can be removed easily. And we have raised that with ZEC because it's a very serious problem.
Voting is yet to end in a few hours. While the process has been smooth, some candidates have accused the ruling ZANU-PF of campaigning or putting their posters closer to the polling stations, which is prohibited by law. Voters will fill 133 vacancies, which include 28 parliamentary seats and 105 local government council seats. The legislature is now made up of members of the ruling ZANU-PF. Activists will be watching to see if the vote brings in new voices, including those from the opposition, who remain optimistic. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zunamashe from Harare.
Rights activists in Zimbabwe are encouraging media outlets to be truthful in their election coverage to help voters make informed decisions as they go to the polls this weekend. For VOA, Rutendo Mawere reports from the Zimbabwean capital, Harare.
Zimbabwe is holding key parliamentary and local government by-elections Saturday following recalls by a faction of the opposition and the deaths of some of the representatives elected in 2018. Nigel Nyamutumbu, coordinator of the Media Alliance of Zimbabwe, an umbrella group of organizations that promotes media freedom and diversity, says he worries disinformation is being circulated.
I have observed false information around ground surveys that have been said to have been conducted that are inaccurate. We've had cases at which some political gatherings have been said to be cancelled, yet they would have actually been still taking place, as was the case in Bulawayo.
Nyamutumbu says it is important for the public to realize that some mainstream media outlets and social media platforms can be agents of false information.
We have been at the forefront of raising public awareness and to encourage responsible use and discerning among the citizenry, such that they spread information that is verified and that they also do not parrot the same fake news.
Ernest Mudzengi, director of the Media Center in Zimbabwe, says some in the mainstream media are co-opted by political and business elites and care more about their own self-interest than accurately reporting the news.
Lying has become normalized, and we have a situation where news outlets that could help the people are actually being used as propaganda outlets, and they are being used to manipulate the voters. We don't have independent media. Any disseminated information from the point of view of the citizen's interest.
Michelle Dumabiriwasha, a program officer for the International Republican Institute Zimbabwe office, a civic society group that promotes the dissemination of accurate news reporting, says the pre-election environment has been characterized by disinformation.
We believe that misinformation and disinformation can negatively impact on citizen participation in electoral processes. We are urging media and civil society organizations to play a central role in making sure that citizens have access to credible information. And as we believe that credible information can actually empower citizens to be able to make informed decisions when they participate in democratic processes.
Some Zimbabweans who spoke to VOA said that it is the responsibility of the media to be truthful in their elections coverage so that people have enough information about the candidates and can make informed decisions. Silence Charumbira says,
The role of the media is to report objectively. Unfortunately, if you look at how the mainstream media is reporting these by-elections, there is no objectivity. So in terms of the quality of information, I think the media is lacking. The media should do better. The media should inform people adequately, sufficiently, timely, so that people get to know what is happening around the country where the by-elections are being undertaken.
For VOA, this is Rutendo Mawere in Harare.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
Nobody, 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 n Tebunda bakukowa nyo. Evidao tebien kana kana anti. sensero bongo te sonika
music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor Mohamed El Shenawy and Producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the rain wet the leopard spots, but does not wash them off. I'm your host, Peter Clotet, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.